Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Don Vanderhoof. Don has spent most of his life serving his community. He was one of the chief organizers of Strawberry Days and Ski Spree for many years. He established the Drums Along the Rockies program, and in 1987, the Chamber recognized his tireless efforts by selecting him as Citizen of the Year. Toward the end of his career in banking, he volunteered to serve 8 years as city councilman, the last two as mayor. Don sat down with me recently to talk about his family and life in the valley. Just a note, Don is on oxygen these days, so the background sound you hear is his respirator.
The Vanderhoof started in Holland, in the Netherlands. Cornelius Vanderhoven and his brother tried to overthrow the government back there and failed and were both executed. Their two wives and six children between the two sisters were banished to the New World and arrived in New Amsterdam, which is now New York City, on the ship Der Beaver in 1648. Over the next 300 years or so, had slowly migrated to the West. They came into Illinois, Pennsylvania, then Illinois, and of course scattered all over the Midwest. And what we feel is the modern Vanderhoof era started in a little town in eastern Kansas called Paola. And this is where the grandfather was born and grew up, and he married the richest girl in town. She was the daughter of the local district judge, and they farmed around in the eastern Kansas. Finally, Luther, my grandfather's brother, moved to eastern Colorado around Hugo and talked my grandfather into moving from the Paola area to eastern Colorado, in the neighborhood of south of Hugo, actually. And they were dryland farmers out there. My father, Roy, and his older brother, Tom, were born back in Kansas. The rest of the children were born, and there were three more. They were born in Colorado. When Tom, the number one child, finished the eighth grade, that's as far as the Hugo schools went, and they had to move, so they moved to Rocky Ford. Rocky Ford was, of course, a much larger town and had a sugar factory. Grandfather then ended up working for the sugar factory.
Dryland farming in eastern Colorado was not an easy life.
It was a very, very hard life.
Do you have stories, family stories of that time?
Some, yes. My dad tells the time that in the morning, first thing that he and Tom had to do when they got up, and this was, of course, in the summer and spring and fall, was go out and kill any rattlesnakes that were in the yard. We had a family reunion in Rocky Ford a few years back and went out and found the where their homestead was. And in 360 degrees, as far as you could see, it was nothing but bleakness. I don't know how they could possibly have ever raised enough crops there. It was dry and arid, and it was just not a nice place to live at all.
So what was that period with when Luther, your grandfather, and your grandmother were out there? What years?
This would have been 1905 or 1906. When they moved from Kansas. It was very, very bleak. I think it was when they moved to Rocky Ford, my dad said it was like moving to a lush paradise compared to the dryland farm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Don Vanderhoof. Don's dad, Roy, grew up in Rocky Ford and fell in love with Irene Church. They got married when Roy returned from World War I, and they started a business.
My dad and a gentleman, I don't remember his name anymore, started a business where they would go out and buy fields of cantaloupe, buy it with cantaloupe in the, they buy the cantaloupe as they still were in the field. I don't know how they decided on the prices. And they would then harvest it and sell it.
So somebody would grow it, and then they would go out and buy the field.
Buy the field, yeah. Buy the field.
Interesting.
And I think that they did well enough to keep food on the table, but nothing else. And they traveled all over. Harvest seasons were a little different, and they followed the harvest season from Rocky Ford down into Arizona and out into California, finally, where their season would usually end. They did okay, but not, they weren't setting the world on fire. But it was, I think it was an interesting, my mother would say that the main thing she did during that period of time was pack and unpack, and then pack again, because they were on the move constantly.
So they were nomads in a way.
They really were, yeah. And this was in the 1920s, but they had a good life. Of course, they were newly married, and very much in love, and had a wonderful time doing that, although they didn't make a lot of money.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Don Vanderhoof. Don's parents, Irene and Roy, eventually got tired of the road and moved to Fort Collins to be closer to Roy's brothers.
Uncle Charlie had about 180 acres of beautiful rolling land. And he talked my dad into moving up from Fort Collins up into the Stove Prairie area. Very, very remote at the time. It was, I think, about 30 miles west of Fort Collins, up through Wrist Canyon, dirt roads, not gravel. You got to town maybe once a month. If you really were a nomad, you went to town twice a month. And they had a wonderful time up there. There again, they didn't make a lot of money. Their main crop was potatoes and lettuce. They sold that to, drove it to Fort Collins during harvest season and sold it. And they had some livestock, not a lot, but they had a wonderful time up there. Both my brother, sister and I, as it happened back in those days, it was not uncommon for the mother-to-be to go to her home to have the baby. And my mother did that on all three occasions of the three children. She went back to Rocky Ford and had each of us. In fact, my brother, my sister and I were all born in the same house, same room, same bed, but my grandmother thought that they'd had a new mattress between births, but we were all born in the same room and had a wonderful time. I don't remember it. I have no recollection. I was only three when my brother finished eighth grade and we had to move to town so he could continue his...
So John was quite a bit older than
he
you.
He was about 10 years older.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Don Vanderhoof. When Don was in ninth grade, his brother John was graduating from high school in Fort Collins. John had plans of going to college and becoming a veterinarian, but life had other plans.
Well, the war came along. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and Johnny immediately joined the Navy Air Force and became a fighter pilot. And that changed our lives completely. Shortly after 1941, Johnny did all the training, became a Navy fighter pilot, flew the Wildcat on the carrier Intrepid. Johnny had a very successful career as a pilot, shot down several Japanese planes, but was shot down twice himself. And I was hit by ground fire and was shot down and landed in Truk Bay. Got out of the plane and was in a little one-man life raft for a day and a half. And they flew a Corsair seaplane to him finally and picked him up and took him back to the carrier.
What are your memories of that time? You know, you probably didn't know where he was half the time at home.
Most of the time. We would get a V letter. Oh, gosh. We'd get two or three at a time that would maybe have been written 2 months before, you know. But he got back to the carrier. And we had this is all stories from him. We had no idea what was going on, as you've said. But he was slightly injured in that when he went down in Truk Bay. Scrapes and bruises and one serious cut on the arm is all that he had. And he was recuperated for a couple of weeks on the carrier, on the Bunker Hill. His boss, said, "Hey, Vanderhoof, you want to take another shot at Truk?" And he said, "Absolutely." He got another airplane, flew back, strafing Truk, and he got hit with ground fire. Blew a hole. He said you could drive a car through in his right wing. But he managed to get back to the carrier. And he flew around in a circle for an hour or so, or he said it seemed like an hour. I think it was much less, until all the other planes, the undamaged planes, landed. Then they brought in the two or three planes that had been damaged. He attempted to, and he had this huge hole in his right wing, and none of his systems worked. You couldn't get the wheels down. The plane would barely flew. But he, finally it was his turn to try to land, and he was going to land without wheels. And he was coming in, they waved him off. He was either too high or too low or what. They waved him off when he put the power back to the plane. The torque with that hole in that wing turned him. He flew upside down the full length of the carrier. When he cut back, he thought he was going to crash. So he cut back on the power, and when he did that, the plane righted itself. And they said, "We ain't going to do that again." So they told him to go off to a certain area and bail out, and they would pick him up. An officer and a seaman were in charge of seeing where he landed and everything. And he went off to that area, and they told him to bail out, which he tried to do, but he had to crank the canopy back by hand because the system wasn't working. And when he did that, he went over the side of the plane. The canopy snapped shut on his parachute. He managed to reach up, pull the canopy, and he slid off the side of the plane. But the tail caught him and broke both his legs. He doesn't remember pulling the ripcord, landing, doesn't remember anything. And he woke up in sick bay of a destroyer. A destroyer just happened to be chugging by and saw the parachute and went over and picked him up. He woke up in the sick bay of the destroyer, was transferred to the hospital ship. Hospital ship took him to Hawaii. And we did get a letter. He says, "I can't tell you how bad." He said, "I'm fine, but you'll have to, when I get home, Vandy, you're going to have," that's what they call my dad, "you're going to have to delay our fishing trips up onto, because I'm not going to be hiking for a while," which told us something was wrong with his legs. So we knew he was alive.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Don Vanderhoof. Don's brother, John, spent months in a naval hospital in San Diego. Finally, when he was well enough to move, he was transferred to the Naval Hospital in Glenwood Springs, better known as the Hotel Colorado.
And I remember my folks getting out the highway map, trying to find out where the hell Glenwood Springs was. And we never heard of it. He was married by that time. As soon as they got here, within a week or so, we packed up to come to Glenwood. And I did not want to leave Fort Collins. I was just had finished my ninth year of school and finished Lincoln Junior High. And I'd lived all my life, short life at that time, waiting to get into Fort Collins High School.
Well, so when they got the news that Johnny was in the hospital, they shut everything down over there, business and everything, and let's go.
Everything continued as usual, but Johnny fell in love with the area. And he talked my dad into selling everything out, selling our house, and moved to Glenwood and opened Van Sporting Goods. And
why Sporting Goods? Where did that come from?
My dad and Johnny both were avid fishermen and hunters. And that's what Johnny wanted to do. He opened the sporting goods store, very successful business. My brother got into politics and was elected as a state representative. And he became Speaker of the House, was highly thought of by the other legislators.
So how did you get into the transition from sporting goods to banking? How did that happen?
Johnny was in the legislature. One of the head of the Democratic Party in Denver was a guy by the name of George Rock. George Rock and my brother became good friends. And George talked my brother into starting a bank.
So how did you get in?
I was working for the highway department. We had been transferred on a temporary basis to Grand Junction. We had just finished the bridge. I had a new child. It was born the week that we moved from Glenwood to Grand Junction, and worked down there for about 2 or 3 years. And my dad called and said, come up, we need to talk with you. So I drove up to Glenwood, and they talked me into quitting the highway department. They needed another person at the bank. And the reason basically for that was, I think Johnny was in the midst of making the decision of to run for governor or not. And he was busy. He didn't want to spend any time in the bank.
Right.
And he never did. I came to work for him, and the bank seldom saw, he seldom saw the inside of the bank after that, which was wonderful for me. But because
not to have your big brother around,
and
looking over your shoulder.
I don't know what my career would have been with the highway department, but it certainly wouldn't have been as successful as it was with in the banking business.
Did you like it? Did you take to it?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. There was a lot of pressure, and parts of it I did not like. I did not like making credit. Collection calls and that part of it. I enjoyed the bookkeeping and the that side of the bank. I enjoyed a lot. In fact, I keep the best set of books of anybody in the country, I think, privately, because that's what I did all my life.
Yeah. And, so you were a numbers guy.
I was a numbers guy.
And all along, I mean, you wouldn't want to be in the banking business if you weren't.
No. But it... And I had good, Dan Handy was an accountant here in town. He was a good teacher. I didn't know anything about. I'd taken bookkeeping in high school, but he was a good teacher. And I enjoyed it a lot.
So he sort of took you under his wing?
Kind of.
He was a mentor of sorts?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Don learned a lot about serving his community over the years, and he grew the reputation of the Glenwood Industrial Bank. So when a bank scandal hit some of the industrial banks on the eastern slope, Don and his family worked hard to secure FDIC accreditation and move the bank to full service.
Changed our name to Glenwood Independent Bank and grew so quickly that we had to move out of our little offices downtown, out to 16, 20 grand, and operated very successfully there for a period of time until J.B., the owner of Westar Bank, made us such an offer that we couldn't turn down. And I was getting up, you know, I was getting ready to retire, and it was time that, and Steve, my son Steve, was in the business and had done, had been a very, very positive influence on them, on the bank, and did a tremendous job. But we sold out to Westar. And then I was on the board of Westar for a period of time, and then Westar sold out to U.S. Bank.
It's been a pretty good tour, huh?
Oh, yeah. Glenwood has, I think,
kind of grew on you?
Oh, God, you wouldn't. Greatest town in the world. And I think that, and I don't want to be a braggart, but I think we've been a good influence, then good for Glenwood, but Glenwood's given us far more than we ever gave out.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program, and my interview has been with Don Vanderhoof. Don is one of the few people alive who worked on the Glenwood Bridge that is now being dismantled, so we had to end this interview with a bridge story.
I was a 20-year-old kid, newly married. I was the new hire. And that was my first project with the highway department. We did all of their surveying. This started a year before the bridge actually was finished, in late 51, early 52, whenever. And we built the bridge. The contract, as I remember it, was well under $1 million. Now I don't, it's $100 and some million or whatever. Was completed in under a year. And one of the interesting things there is, years later, I walked into the post office on my way to work one morning, and the guy said, "Hey, did you hear that this little boy drowned in the Colorado River yesterday?" It was, must have been a Monday morning. He said, "Drowned?" And I said, "Where? What happened?" He said, "Well, he got caught on some kind of a piece of metal that was stuck in the south bank of the river, right out in the shallow water. But his kayak got hooked up on that, tipped over, and his dad was downstream from him, couldn't get back, and the poor kid drowned." And he said, "I wonder what there was out there that would snag that that canoe." And I said, "I know exactly what it was." I said, "It was a piling for the temporary bridge that had been put up on Pitkin Avenue when the old Von Rosenberg Bridge was torn out and they were putting the new bridge in." I said, "I know exactly that's what it was." And he said, "Well, I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to get a hold of the highway department, tell them they've got to take that thing out." About 3 days later, walking in early morning, about 7:30 in the morning, unlocking the door of the bank, and there was a car parked out in front with two men in it, and they said they were from the highway department, and they needed to talk to me. We went in, sat down, and they said, "We are here to complain that you're making false claims about the highway department." I said, "In what way is that?" He said, "Well, you say that it was a bridge piling that caused the canoe to upset and drown that boy." And he said, "We never had a bridge there." And I said, "Yeah, you did." And they said, "No, we didn't." I said, "Well, I happened to work for the highway department when we put the bridge in." And they said, "No, you're mistaken." And I got up and went out. We had a long hallway into the bank with all these pictures, old-time Glenwood pictures. And one of the pictures was of the old temporary bridge, taken from the south bank looking over towards the Colorado Hotel. Perfect picture of the bridge. You can see Gallagher's restaurant and the Hotel Colorado in the back. And I picked that off of the wall and took it back and handed it to them. And this one guy said, "I'll be goddamned." And this other guy said, "I'll be a son of a bitch." And said there is no record at all of that bridge ever existing. I said, well, it did. It served us well in the community while they were tearing the old bridge down. The next day, there was a highway department crew in there pulling that old.
That's a great story.
Yeah. And
that must have been fun.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Here's evidence exhibit number one.
Yes. Yeah, I'll be goddamn. But,
so did they apologize profusely? They must have.
They said they were so sorry.
That was Don Vanderhoof. Don and his family have been serving Glenwood Springs and the Valley for generations. As I mentioned in the outset of the interview, Don received the Citizen of the Year Award in 1987. In 2016, his son Steve earned the same award for his service to the community. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories program. For more on immigrant stories, please go to our website, immigrantstories.net, or to kdnk.org.